So I'm cloned. If anybody has any questions about how that was done, you can run over to the other talk after. But thank you for having me here. I'm going to talk a little bit about my work in India. But first, I have no relationships to disclose. And I wanted to let you know the aims of this particular study. I went to India and lived there for about 9 or 10 months several years ago now, and did my field work there in South India, and basically rotated with psychiatrists at NIMHANS, the National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences in Bangalore, India. And my original intent was to study the shape and expression of mental illness, mild to moderate mental illness, specifically at NIMHANS, and how people presented their symptoms. But one of the things that I was struck by particularly was the reports of women. And so what I did was I did kind of an ethnographic study and published the quantitative work first in the journal called Psychopathology, and kind of took some time to analyze the qualitative data that I'll be presenting here. So my aim with examining the qualitative data was to examine determinants of depressive symptoms among the women that were seeking treatment in the psychiatric hospital. And I went into the analysis and the fieldwork in general knowing that culture and factors such as stigma can shape emotional experience and influence how people express their symptoms. For those of you who aren't familiar with Western concepts of depression and depressive symptoms, these are the symptoms according to the DSM-4 and the ICD-10, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders that we use in the States. It corresponds with the International Statistical Classification of Diseases that they use in India. And it's important to kind of consider that two main symptoms, either or, are instrumental in formulating a current major depressive episode diagnosis. That's depressed moods of feeling tearful and sad, and anhedonia, which is basically diminished interest or pleasure in activities that people normally take part in. There are all these other symptoms involved with a depressive diagnosis as well: weight loss or weight gain, insomnia or hypersomnia, psychomotor agitation, fatigue, loss of energy, feelings of worthlessness and guilt, and diminished ability to think or concentrate, and recurrent thoughts of death or suicidal ideation. The research does tell us that there are certain determinants of mental illness. Most of us subscribe to the stress diathesis model, which kind of tells us that nature and nurture are responsible for an expression of depressive symptoms. Poverty can shape mental illness. Things like your gender, whether you're male or female, can influence the expression of depressive symptoms. Your age can tell you certain times when certain disorders are present. War, conflicts, and disasters can bring about certain mental illnesses. And then physical diseases, and much of my work actually is in HIV and depression and stigma, and we find, you know, nearly somewhere around 30% of people with HIV have diagnosable depressive disorders. And then your social and emotional environment can impact mental illness and its onset. So what I did was I first started by assessing my participants on basic sociodemographic variables, but then I went into kind of a more ethnographic interview called the Explanatory Model Interview Catalog, or the EMIC. And the EMIC kind of starts out by asking very broad questions, like what brought you in here for treatment, and what do you think might be causing these problems? So this I call the open-ended inquiry kind of phase of this study, where I probed people and their responses to get clarity and that sort of thing. And then I went into kind of a symptom-directed inquiry type of interview, where I conducted a structured clinical interview for the DSM-4, which basically you ultimately have a measure of, you can diagnose them with a major depressive disorder or an anxiety disorder after doing that. I only completed the mood disorders module and the anxiety disorders module of the SCID when I conducted that work. And all of these interviews were conducted in the native language of the region in Kannada. So, for those of you who don't know where Bangalore is, it's in South India on the Deccan Plateau. It's circled here. And these are kind of the grounds of Nimhans Hospital. They have a nice sign in the entryway, and all of the different languages that are spoken in the region, English, Kannada, Hindi. And this is actually the building where I conducted my field work, where it's oftentimes the screening clinic is oftentimes the place where people first come in for their present with their illness. Their first, I guess, contact with this hospital is in this particular building. And typically what happens is on an average morning around 7:30 in the morning, something like 300 people kind of gather in the waiting room with family members. And you can imagine that it can become a quite tense situation in the waiting room because there are maybe only four or five psychiatric residents that are seeing all 300 patients throughout the day. And so they need a security guard to kind of keep the peace at the time. There's a severe shortage of mental health care workers in India. And this is the office where I interviewed my participants. I actually interviewed 62 people total, and 32 of them were women. And not surprisingly, 75% of them met criteria for major depressive disorder diagnosis. And so these are women that are presenting in a psychiatric hospital, so such a high number isn't at all unusual. But most of the women, as you can see, were married and kind of split between living in an urban area or rural area, because Nimhans is kind of a hospital that's one of a kind and located in South India and draws from people from many of the surrounding rural areas, including, you know, people come from as far as Nepal because they've heard treatment there is high quality treatment, so they come and they stay on the grounds and obtain treatment there. So just to go back for a second, what didn't surprise me was that 75% of the women met criteria for a major depressive disorder diagnosis. But what ended up surprising me were the narratives that the women told. So I'm going to give you a couple of snapshots of what some of the women told me. When I asked them, these responses were mainly in response to what do you think is the cause of your illness? And, you know, why might you be coming for treatment today? So I used the pseudonym Leela for this first woman. She was 50 years old and had an arranged marriage when she was about 15. And she had three children. Her husband and family would beat her regularly. 8 years before our interview, her daughter committed suicide after a confrontation with her father. And this is a direct quote from her, translated. I might have been happy if my daughter was alive. Now I feel tension, anxiety, and sadness, always sadness. I don't sleep. I have many problems in my household. It is my husband that causes me to worry. What happens inside our house, no one can see. And then the second woman, I'll call her Sita, was 28 years old, and she had two children. And she worried about getting her daughter married. She believed she was too poor to save for an adequate dowry, and her first husband recently passed away. So she now feels guilty that she remarried as a way of supporting her children, but feels guilty now that she did so. So much so that she's attempted suicide in the past, and the mother of her first husband criticizes her for remarrying, and she's ill-treated by her neighbors because she's a widow who remarried. So here's her kind of direct quotation about her life. Near my home, there are some people who look at me and laugh. They make fun of me. I'm sad about this. I think about all this when it's time. I feel like I'm doing things wrong. I just want to die. Yesterday, I was sweeping the floor, and I threw some dust somewhere. And the neighbors got mad and came and hit me. They gave me a lot of trouble. My neighbor took kerosene and died because her husband was treating her poorly, and I wanted to do the same thing, but I worry about my daughter. So you can see, I actually have a third snapshot, but I'm a little afraid of time, so I might just skip that. You can see that, actually, one of the things I like to explain is it actually took me a while to process some of these quotations and get around to analyzing the data, because it was, you know, interview after interview, these women telling me these very rough stories. But it wasn't until I actually gravitated more towards global health that I started reading Paul Farmer that I started realizing, okay, well, this seems to match exactly what he's talking about. These are examples of structural violence. This is clearly the social structure is causing harm. So I think I started to make sense of some of the data that I was noticing. And if you think about it, you know, the women are expected to live with their husband and his family. There are no domestic violence shelters in India. This is, I learned, widows are not allowed to remarry and arranged marriages are preferred. So all of these women are kind of struggling against all of these rules and regulations, and ultimately is causing them harm. Amartya Sen called this similar concept unfreedoms. And, you know, I'm a stigma researcher, so I very much started to see the multiple stigmas that these women were facing, stigmas associated with just being women and being impoverished. So there's been a lot of other research that's come out of India where they've tied depressive symptoms to intimate partner violence, partner alcoholism, psychological trauma. And Arthur Kleinman as well has written a lot about the people that he saw in China living with mental illness, and also describing their powerlessness to alter their environment that they live in. And what struck me was that in a sense, these women were coming in for psychiatric treatment, and you know, minutes later, they would be seeing a psychiatrist after they saw me that would prescribe them with tricyclic antidepressants. And it struck me as kind of unusual that we're, in a sense, treating this flaw in the social structure with antidepressant medications. So I started looking into this a little bit more and realizing that we need to put this in the context of the fact that death by suicide or domestic violence in India is actually fairly common for young women to die this way, which is very sad. But then again, these women that came to see me at NIMHANS, they're different. They didn't succumb to suicide or weren't killed by their family members. Ultimately, they presented for a psychiatric clinic for treatment. They wanted to live. And one of the women whose stories I didn't detail talked about how her daughter made her want to live. She needed somebody to take care of her. So there's something about that I think we need to explore more. But also, I just wanted to give a few final thoughts. I don't think that it's wrong necessarily to treat with antidepressant medications for these women that have depressive symptoms and are suffering. But at the same time, maybe we could prevent these symptoms from happening by investing in upstream kind of interventions that can, you know, lead to empowerment of these women before they develop these depressive symptoms. So I'm hoping that work like this can kind of develop that theme a little bit more, and we can invest more in these kind of upstream interventions, or something like community organizing, which a group that I've recently come across called Sahi Yog is working on in North India. Because the voice of many people can impact societies and communities much more than the voice of just one. So I wanted to acknowledge a few people that kind of helped me and pushed me to continue to analyze this data. My mentor, Dr. Raghuram, who used to be at NIMHANS and is now at the Kempegowda Institute of Medical Sciences, and Randall Horton at Seattle University. So, and my Career Development Award, of course. Thank you.